I'm Jordan Abel, Director of Public Programs at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is social psychologist Jennifer Eberhardt. She's joined in conversation by San Francisco Police Chief Bill Scott. And now, join Marcy Glazer on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces Jennifer Eberhardt and Bill Scott.
Dr. Jennifer Eberhardt is a Stanford University social psychologist and recipient of the 2014 MacArthur Genius Grant, who studies how we interact with one another. For more than two decades, she has been unpacking implicit racial bias and how our perceptions of race play into our everyday interactions, even and especially when we're not aware of it. She has trained police departments and guided tech startups on recognizing their own implicit bias and how it affects their work. Her new book, just out last week, which is based on her extensive research, is called Biased: Uncovering the Hidden Prejudice That Shapes What We See, Think, and Do. After a short talk, she will be joined in conversation by San Francisco Police Chief William Bill Scott. Prior to joining the SFPD in January of 2017, Chief Scott served for 27 years in the Los Angeles Police Department. He rose through the ranks to become Deputy Chief of LAPD's South Bureau after being promoted to Commander in 2012. Chief Scott grew up in Birmingham, Alabama, and attended the University of Alabama, where he earned a degree in accounting and is a graduate of Senior Management Institute of Policing. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Eberhardt to our stage.
Thank you. Thank you for coming, and thank you for that introduction. It's an honor to stand here before you today to celebrate the publication of my first book, Biased. There it is. So I'm a social psychologist, and using a wide variety of methods and populations, I've conducted numerous studies documenting the power of race to dictate perception and behavior, even as we remain blind to its operation and to the severity of its consequences. My research is driven not only by my desire to, or my curiosity, I guess, about human behavior, but also my desire to address significant social problems. And much of my current work focuses on race and policing and criminal justice. I've had a long-standing interest in how social perception can influence our visual perception, and that particular relationship appears in high relief in the context of criminal justice. So I have studies that I talk about in the book where we simply expose people to black faces, and we found that that can facilitate their detection of crime objects, that simple exposure to those faces, prompting people to think about violent crime. I found can lead people to look more at black faces and away from white faces. Prompting police officers to think of shooting and arresting and capturing and so forth can lead their eyes to focus in on black faces. And officers judge black faces that they perceive as more stereotypically black, as more criminal than those with less stereotypically black features. And although looking black is not a crime, jurors are more likely to deliver a death sentence to those black felons who are judged to have more stereotypically black features, at least when their victims are white. And just as the blackness of a defendant can increase people's desire to punish, so too can the blackness of a penal institution increase their acceptance of punitive criminal justice policies. Over the last several decades, punitive criminal justice policies have both dramatically increased the incarceration rate in this country and also exacerbated the racial disparities in incarceration. So as we know today, although blacks make up about 12% of the U.S. population, they make up nearly 40% of the prison population. And although statistics like these are recited in an effort to motivate people to question how draconian our criminal justice system has become, I found that voters who are prompted to believe that the prison population is more black actually show more support for punitive policies, not less. So I'm a social psychologist. This is the kind of work that I do. I'm also a descendant of slaves and sharecroppers. My people are from Alabama and from Georgia. They moved to Cleveland, Ohio in the 1920s and in the 1940s to escape the terror of the Jim Crow South and to embrace the promise of the North to protect them. So I was born in Cleveland, Ohio. I was born in the year of the Voting Rights Act, in the wake of the Civil Rights Movement, in the first generation of those who would later be incarcerated in unprecedented numbers. I was born in an all-black world. And when my parents decided that we would move to an all-white suburb called Beechwood when I was 12 years old, my life was changed. I had access to resources that I didn't even know existed. I was in a place suddenly where everyone was expected to go to college, to do great things, to succeed. And I couldn't help but recognize the relationship, a tight relationship between race and opportunity. That move to Beechwood, although it was just a bike ride away for me, raised all kinds of questions in my mind about race, questions that I never stopped seeking answers to. James Baldwin once wrote, "A journey is called that because you cannot know what you will do with what you find, or what you find will do to you." In this book, Biased, I take readers on a journey. I take them into neighborhoods, in schools and workplaces and police departments. And at each stop along the way, I try to light up the way bias operates. I explain its effects on our vision, on our choices, on our actions, again, even when we're not aware of it. And I blend the science of bias with the stories of those who have been affected by it. So though we're often blind to bias, I light up the harms, the devastation that bias can leave in its wake. The book opens with a scene of me at the Oakland Police Department, and I'm there to deliver a training on implicit bias to for this particular training, there were 132 officers in an auditorium that was similar to this, actually. And I walk in to the room, and I mean, I could feel the chill, you know, in the room. They were there and sort of seated and ready to be lectured at from their perspective. You know, they were there in full gear, and they had on their bulletproof vest, and they had taut faces and distant eyes, and they weren't having it, right? I could tell right away I was going to have trouble, and I could tell that I was facing a hostile crowd for the first time in my career, and you know, there was no booing or yelling or any of that. It was sort of an active, quiet resistance that I felt, and it was hard to break through it. And so I was trying everything I could. When I got up here, I was showing slides, and I was, you know, going through demos, and I was trying to crack jokes, and nothing landed, nothing worked. And I'm thinking, oh, man, you know, how am I gonna like make it through this? I had about 2 hours to go just with that session, right? And then I had 11 more of these sessions to do. And I thought, man, whose idea was this? You know, to do it? Turned out it was my idea. At the time, it seemed like a good idea because, you know, I was there as a subject matter expert, and I was about to release a report along with a number of researchers at Stanford. We'd worked hard on this for actually a couple years, and I was worried about how they were going to receive that report, and I didn't want to be in the position of community members calling on me to do a training after that report came out, and so I thought it would be better to do it before. And I thought they would be in a better position to listen, you know, to the message before the report came out. And this was a report that was about, you know, their stops and searches in the city. And we had found that there were, you know, pretty large racial disparities there and their enforcement activity. And so I knew that if I waited to deliver the message around bias, that they would just turn a deaf ear to it. So I was in a kind of a pickle. I was trying to figure out what to do. And so I decided to just put down all the, you know, the slides and stop telling the stories and all of that of the research. And I decided to tell a personal story. And this was a story about my son, who was just 5 years old at the time. And we were on an airplane together, and he's five, right? So he's like wide-eyed, and he's like looking around on the plane. He's all excited to be on the plane with mommy. And he sees this guy on the plane, and he says, "Hey, that guy looks like Daddy." And I look at the guy. He doesn't look anything at all like Daddy, like nothing, you know, at all. And then I thought, okay, so I start looking around on the plane, right? And I noticed he was the only black guy on the plane. And I thought, okay, you know, I have to get ready to have a talk with my son about how not all black people look alike, right? So I'm thinking, how am I going to do this, right? He's five, and I was trying to get it together in my mind. And then I decided, you know, children see the world differently, you know, from adults. They haven't had this training and this conditioning that kind of directs their eyes to see in a certain way. And so I thought, well, maybe, just maybe, this guy does bear some resemblance to my husband, and I just can't see it. So I decided, before I had that lecture, to just give it a shot. So I look at the guy, and I'm looking at him. I look at his height. He's about 4 inches shorter than my husband. And I look at his weight. I look at his body build. I look at his skin shade. I look at his facial features. I look at his hair. Nothing, nothing, nothing. No matter what I looked at, there was no resemblance that I could find. And I thought, all right, you're going to get the talk, right? So I'm all ready to kind of give him the talk. But before I could say anything, he looks up at me and he says, "I hope he doesn't rob the plane." And I said, "What? What did you say?" And he said it again. He says, "Well, I hope he doesn't rob the plane." And I said, "Well, you know Daddy wouldn't rob a plane." And he says, "Well, yeah, I know that. I know." And I said, "But why would you say that?" And he looked at me with this really sad face, and he said, "I don't know why I said that. I don't know why I was thinking that. We're living with such severe racial stratification that even a five-year-old can tell us what's supposed to happen next. Even with no evildoer, even with no explicit black hatred, this association between blackness and crime made its way into the mind of my five-year-old, and it's made its way into the mind of us. So I tell this story, and I'm at the police department, and I stood there, and I looked out at the crowd hoping for a connection, and I saw one. I saw that their eyes had softened. I'm going to read you a little bit from the book. I just took a deep breath, and when I looked out back at the crowd, I saw the expressions had changed. They were no longer uniformed police officers, and I was no longer a university researcher. We were parents, unable to protect our children from a world that is often bewildering and frightening, a world that influences them so profoundly, so insidiously, and so unconsciously that they and we don't know why we think the way we do. So. So that's the opening to the book. I tell also stories throughout the book about, just kind of people on the ground. I tell stories about myself and my own childhood. I tell about that move, talk about that move to Beechwood, to the suburb in Cleveland. I mentioned that, a big thing that move did for me was to really help me to understand the relationship between race and opportunity. But it also helped me to understand something else, which is, I was nervous about going there because I was worried about how I would be accepted, and I was worried I'd be made fun of, and I didn't know if I would belong there. I had, grown up in this black world, and so I just hadn't been around people who were outside my own race very much. I didn't have really meaningful connections or relationships with people who weren't black, and so I just didn't know how it was going to go. So I go into that space, and I go into the school, and I'm nervous. And I found out, that these children were ready to welcome me. They wanted to show me around the school, and they were, happy that I was there. They wanted to be friends with me. But I found that it was really hard to make friends, despite all this. And that was because I couldn't tell their faces apart. I'm like, I'm in a sea of white faces, and I could not distinguish one face from another. And my brain had no practice at this at all. And I just felt thrown off and worried, because this was my new school and I wanted to make friends, and I didn't know who my friend was. I'm like, did I talk to you? Were you the friend I spoke to at lunch the other day? And so I was worried that something had happened to me. I didn't have this kind of basic skill that I relied on and that most people rely on, being able to, recognize faces. And so I didn't know what was going on or how long it would last. And it turned out that it didn't, well, it lasted actually for many months, but over time, my brain started getting adjusted to reading faces of other races. And I was reconditioning my brain because I had changed, my context had changed. And so I slowly started to get the hang of it. So it turns out now, just to put a researcher's lens on this, many, many years later, when I was adult, I found out that researchers had been studying what they call this other race effect for decades. They have found that already at 3 months of age, babies are showing a preference for faces of their own race.
You're listening to social psychologist Jennifer Eberhardt whose new book is Biased, Uncovering the Hidden Prejudice That Shapes What We See, Think, and Do. She's joined in conversation by San Francisco Police Chief Bill Scott on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
So already at infant, as we're infants, we're being conditioned to respond to people who are like us and people who are in our environment, people who are around us. And as we do, we lose our sensitivity to responding to those who are outside of our circle. When I got to Stanford, I started to, as a researcher, look at this, and I was interested in looking at the, neurological components of it. And so I did work with a number of Stanford researchers where we looked at this part of our brain that neuroscientists call the fusiform face area. And so this part of the brain is implicated in recognizing faces. So what we found, though, is that this area of the brain didn't light up as much. It didn't respond as much to faces of other races as compared to faces of the participant's own race. And the less it responded, the worse a person's memory was for that face. And I wanted to just talk to you about this because, I mean, not just to go through time and talk about my experience as a kid and move and fast forward to me as an adult and the research that I do. I want to talk to you about it because it's a precursor, this lack of our ability to recognize faces of those outside of our own group is a precursor for bias. And it's a precursor for bias because if you can't distinguish one person from another, you can't tell, you know, good from bad, we cease to see people as individuals, and those individuals simply become a representative of their category. And then once you do that, all the feelings that we have about people in that category and our ideas and our beliefs about people in that category come alive, and they get easily applied to the person who's standing in front of you. Now, this work actually took on new meaning when I went to Oakland and I was helping with their reform efforts there in the police department. At the time I got there, it was about, I said I was going to say a year. This was 2014, and I'm still there. This is my fifth year, actually, in Oakland. But the first year I got there, I learned about the string of robberies, strong-arm robberies that were occurring in the city. So the crime rate was down. It was actually way down from previous years. But they had this uptick in crime in Chinatown. And it turned out that there were black teenagers in Chinatown who were stealing the purses from middle-aged Chinese women. And they would go there and they would sort of target that area and they would steal their purses. And the Chinese women were not used to seeing black faces. A lot of them, they had just come to the U.S. Recently, and so it was hard for them to figure out, to help the police to sort of catch the culprits, to say who had stolen their purse, and so. The police department was just stymied by this. They were trying to figure out what to do because, without, being able to ID, a person, a suspect, it was hard to charge the cases and so forth. And so they started asking the young men, well, why did you choose Chinatown? Why are you going there and why are you focused in on these women? And they told the police officers, well, we go there because they can't tell the brothers apart. Right? So even they seemed to have a sense of, this research and had a sense of what was happening and how our brains function in this way. So I want to just, tell you one other story that's actually also in the book that kind of talks about how this association between blackness and crime can spread well beyond policing. And so we see it in our court system. We see it in the prisons. And it also spreads beyond the criminal justice system to our neighborhoods. You know, it affects our schools and our workplaces, so much so that race itself can become a stand-in for wrongdoing rather than actual criminal activity. And so another story that I talk about in the book was a story of a tech company that you may have heard of, Nextdoor. They are this, you know, they're their platform that's designed to bring neighbors together to create happier and safer and healthier communities. But they soon discovered that they were having a problem with racial profiling on their platform. So people were using race, again, as a proxy for a suspicious person. And so the neighbors would get on this platform and they would warn others about, say, a suspicious black man in an otherwise white space. And sometimes they would call the police, right, for backup. And so that's when Sarah Leary, who was one of the founders of Nextdoor, contacted me. So she reached out. She knew that I was a researcher at Stanford and I studied bias. And so she was trying to figure out how do you curb bias on Nextdoor. And so she talked to me and she consulted the literature and she's trying to like dig down in all this esoteric language about bias to see if there's some solution there, if there's some nugget that she can use to help to solve this problem. And so she found that bias is most likely to surface in situations that where we're fearful and where we're moving fast, right? So bias is, you know, it's something that we're all vulnerable to, but it's not something that's triggered all the time in every situation. There's certain situations that bring it alive more than others. And when we are under threat or when we're fearful, when we have to make decisions really quickly, that bias can come alive. And so the issue here, the rub here for Nextdoor was that, you know, they're a tech company, right? And so speed is the holy grail of technology. So most of these tech products are created with the aim of reducing friction. So they want to reduce friction so they can guide the user through a process rapidly and intuitively and so easily. So you don't even have to think about what's going on. It's all quick and fluid. But these are exactly the kinds of situations or the kinds of conditions that lead us to rely on subconscious bias. So to curb racial bias on that platform, Nextdoor had to contemplate slowing people down. And so they decided to take the risk to actually slow people down, even if that could lead to some drop-off in the users because they were so concerned about this issue. And so they developed this checklist of reminders that people would have to click through before they could make a post about a suspicious person. And so they were told to focus on behavior, to give a full description of the person, including their clothing and what distinguishes them from other sort of similar people. They were told not to assume criminality based on race and that racial profiling was prohibited. And so the posting process was set up to try to push people past this idea, you know, if you see something, say something, to if you see something suspicious, say something specific. And so that's what they were trying to do. And through that process, they were able, by adding this friction, right, they were able to reduce racial profiling on the platform by 75%. So that's huge, right? So it's using something that's fairly simple that we know as researchers that when people are in a hurry, when they have to make decisions quickly, they fall back on bias because that's the thing that they have these automatic associations that they're falling back on, and those get used, and those can infect decision making. So I just want to read you a couple lines before I sit down with Chief Scott here in the book. Okay. Bias is not limited to one domain of life. It's not limited to one profession, one race, or one country. It is also not limited to one stereotypic association. This book grew from my research on the Black Crime Association, yet it's not the only association that matters, and blacks are not the only group affected. Probing the role of implicit bias in the criminal justice arena can teach us broader lessons about who we are, where we've been, and what we can become, regardless of our social group or the groups toward which we may be biased. Neither our evolutionary path nor our present culture dooms us to be held hostage by bias. Change requires a kind of open-minded attention that is well within our reach. There are successful approaches we can learn from and new ways of thinking that we can build upon, whether we are trying to change ourselves or the settings where we live, work, and learn. So with that, I'm going to invite Chief Scott to come out here to join me in a conversation about bias. Thank you. So, fire away.
First of all, hello, everybody. So I was thrilled to be invited to this discussion with Dr. Eberhardt here this evening because long before I moved to San Francisco, I actually became familiar with her work. And really my interest, number one, it's a fascinating body of research and it's a fascinating science. But secondly, being in this profession now for going on 30 years, there are so many intersections between this body of work and policing and the criminal justice system as a whole, but particularly for my life's work. And the better that we understand it, the better that I understand it, the better that we understand what drives some of this, you know, implicit bias or even explicit bias, I think the better off we are in terms of the solutions that we can offer to make this situation better. And I was backstage listening to Dr. Eberhardt's introduction, and I have read, you know, the book as well, and it really is a fascinating body of work. But more importantly, we're at a time in society, I think, where we need this work more than ever, and particularly in policing, and understanding really moving forward how we can better police our communities and cities across this country. So I'm thrilled to be here. There's a lot to talk about, so I hope we can cover as much as we can in this short time that we have. But I will start by saying, when you get toward the end of the book, you know, there's something that, and this is actually a pretty short sentence that I think stuck with me, probably resonated more than anything else in the book. I mean, it's a fascinating book, but, you know, where you talk about that you don't have all the answers.
Oh.
Because oftentimes, you know, when we look at our many disparities in the criminal justice system and in policing in terms of disparities with arrest rates and use of force, and you it just goes on and on. And people are really, really concerned when we don't have the answer. And part of what was enlightening here is it's as much about asking the questions to try to figure out, you know, why things are the way they are as having answers. And so that really resonated with me. And I know there's a lot of in your work that goes into that. But really, I think that's kind of where I began is what are the questions that we need to be asking ourselves? And then what are the processes and the strategies as we get the answers to those questions that we can put together to make this situation better? So,
yeah. Yeah. I agree. You know, as a researcher, that's what I do for a living, is ask questions. So, and we kind of get, we inch closer to answers, but then, you know, it just opens up more questions. And so I think there's a humbleness, you know, about all of this, is that you don't need to have all the answers before you, you know, start to work towards solutions. And sometimes it's being close to the problem is what you need. And sometimes those questions get you close to the problem, and you can start to try to work it through you know, learn, you know, as you, right, as you go. So, and I think especially for me as a researcher, and also like working with, you know, various police departments, you know, it's not work that, you know, I would be able to do on my own. I need the input and the help and the direction of people who are within the department who do this work day to day. And so the hope is that we could kind of, you know, share knowledge and experience to kind of move closer to, you know, having a sort of, you know, just, you know, society, a more equal society. And so that's what drives me.
Yeah. So here's another point that I know you and I have discussed since we met, and it really goes back to your story about your first introduction in the meeting in Oakland.
Oh.
And believe me, you know, my time having that conversation in a policing environment about race is a very difficult conversation to have. And I would dare to say that, you know, most officers are hardworking, honest, trying to do the right thing type of people. And oftentimes, particularly when the body of work about implicit bias start to come to the forefront, it was very difficult to have that conversation. Because a lot of people associate that with being a racist.
Yeah.
And I've sat in front of roll calls and training and gotten those blank stares, so I know what that feels like.
Yeah.
But why is that? I mean, I ask you all the time, or I've asked you before, why is that such a difficult conversation, particularly in this line of work, to address?
I mean, it's difficult. I think that's one of the worst things, what used to be one of the worst things you could be called in this country. Things are shifting a little bit now, so I don't know. People just, they're offended by that because, you know, they think when you're talking about bias, you're saying that they are, you know, racist, that they are hate-filled people. You know, that they're bad people. And so it kind of strikes at your core in a way. And so people get, you know, defensive. You know, they don't see themselves that way. They don't believe that about themselves. And so a lot of it has to do with our sense of what bias is, and sort of, and the bias that, you know, I do research on. I mean, a lot of it really is about not something that is, you know, only a few sort of isolated people are doing, and they act in this real extreme way, and they're burning crosses and so forth. But, you know, we're talking about something that everybody is vulnerable to, and we're talking about sort of you know, people who can act on bias without any ill will, without motivation to do that. They could be pulled in that direction despite their desires and despite their intentions. And so I think if we had sort of clearer definitions about what we're talking about, I think those discussions would go better, because people would sort of understand when they take themselves, step back and take themselves out of it a little bit, they can focus more on what the issue is and what needs fixing. And I think definitely we need to have these discussions in law enforcement. And you can't, you know, police, you know, in the world today, especially in diverse communities, and not be able to talk about race or recognize that race is an issue, you know?
Right. So.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's guest is social psychologist Jennifer Eberhardt, who whose new book is Biased, Uncovering the Hidden Prejudice That Shapes What We See, Think, and Do. She's joined in conversation by San Francisco Police Chief Bill Scott. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
So the other thing I think that's really difficult, and I would love to hear your thoughts on this too, when we talk about disparities and the acknowledgement of, really the acknowledgement, number one, that they exist.
Yeah.
And number two, you know, whether or not it's driven by bias, you know, I think most of us think that, whether implicit or otherwise, that some of it is driven by bias. But how important is it for us, law enforcement, to actually have an acknowledgement of this work and the disparities that may be caused by our lack of training or understanding, just how deeply that cuts into policing?
Yeah, I mean, I think when there's no acknowledgement, you know, at all of bias playing any role, I think police officers tend to feel like, you know, they kind of are given a problem, like that they get what they get, and the crime rate is just what it is, and the disparities are strictly coming only from the crime rate and from no other, the racial disparities in the crime rate lead to racial disparities in policing in terms of the stops and the searches and the use of force and so forth. And so when you don't have any discussion at all, you know, about bias, then it allows officers to completely take themselves out of the picture and their own role in producing some of these things. So I think, you know, so for example, I can give you a story. This is actually a hopeful story, if you want a little hope. we need that now, right? So one of the things I'm most proud of in Oakland that we've been able to do is to kind of change the language, you know, around, you know, all of this and change the language around, you know, race and just even helping you know, officers and the executive team be sort of more, willing to engage conversations about race in a serious way. And so one of the big things that people wanted in Oakland is to have the number of stops get drastically reduced because they felt like there were thousands of people being stopped, you know, by the police, and those stops would end without you know, any arrest or the officer would find that there was no wrongdoing. Oftentimes the stops were for very highly discretionary stops, and so they would be sort of traffic stops, say, for broken license plate light or expired tags or something like that. But then the community felt like they were really being stopped for a different reason, because they were the officers had some suspicion about them, and they thought that that was racial. And so what we did was we added, so whenever someone stops someone on the streets or in the car in Oakland, they have to complete a form that indicates all of the different reasons why they made the stop and the conditions of the stop and the location of the stop and so forth. So we work with people in the department and to add a simple question to that form, and it was this, you know, is this stop intelligence led, yes or no? So it was a checkbox, basically, and what they meant by intelligence-led was, do you have specific information about this individual that ties that individual to a specific crime, basically? Right. And so now that question actually slowed them down in a way, right? Because they had to think, you know, is this stop now a high-priority stop or is it not? Do I really need to stop this person? How many of my stops have been intelligence-led versus not? And so it changes the mindset around stops. And so you're not, you know, so it's not, it's just taking it away from intuition and more towards, you know, this sort of metric that you can look at and they can monitor and measure and so forth. So we found that with the addition of that simple question on the stop form, so in 2017, there were 32,000 stops across the city before that addition. And then in 2018, after the addition of that question, the stops plummeted to 19,000. So it's a huge difference, and such a small tweak, right? It's a tweak to a form, but it's a tweak to your mindset. So you're thinking in a different way about what you're doing and what your goal is.
Right. So with that type of change, which sounds on the surface like a small change, but you know, being in management and policing, that small change probably took a huge cultural shift.
Yeah.
How important? You can laugh at that. So,
it did. Yeah.
But how important was it? And I think part of the work that you all did in Oakland through Spark was also to address the culture.
Yeah.
That made it a little bit easier for those type of policies and changes to be put in place. And so, how important is that? And I know from my standpoint, we know that that is very important, but it's very difficult at the same time. So can you talk a little bit about that and how that played into this?
Yeah, culture is huge. And I think one mistake people often make is to wait for the culture to change before they can actually do the work. Because sometimes the work actually is what changes the culture. And so just the statistic that I just gave here, So I could go in and I could talk about, you know, the role of race or the role of bias in policing until I'm like blue in the face, right? Mm-hmm. And it just wouldn't land. The people wouldn't listen to that because their everyday experience was something else. But when we added that question to the form, their everyday experience was actually shifted, and because their everyday experience was shifted, their mindset was shifted, and the culture of the place was shifted, because now they understand that it's not just about what they get and who's committing crime and all that. It's also about their own approach to it. It's also about their own policies. It's about their own practices, because when they change the practice, they could see a huge difference in what was happening. And they were able to do this, right, without the crime rate shooting up. So the crime rate continued to fall as they were stopping thousands and thousands of fewer people across the city. And so it's nothing like evidence that you can sort of see yourself that can shift your mind and shift the culture of the place. It can't just be you come in and give people knowledge about it, because I think they defend against that and they don't believe that. But if you actually change their world, and you're showing them, you know, that actually your behavior matters here. That's what really brought the cultural change there, I think.
And one of the things that's, I think, probably a goal of most, if not all, police departments is to build trust in the communities that they are responsible for serving. So did you see any parallels in your work in Oakland or any other places where, I mean, I think that's hard to quantify, but I think we kind of know when we're hitting the mark in terms of building trust. Right. Did you see any improvement there with just that change?
Well, yeah. I mean, for us, it's about, I don't know if Benoit Monin is here either, but he lives in the city, and he has been like a major collaborator on this work, but he's a Stanford researcher in the business school, and they talk a lot in the business school about footprint and sort of reducing the footprint, like for companies and so forth. And so he was able to bring that language to the Oakland Police Department, and so we often will talk about reducing the negative footprint of the police department in the community. And so we felt like with that that change, where there were fewer, you know, tens of thousands of fewer stops, right? That was a reduction in the footprint, because that was one of the main things that people complained about, was feeling like they were being pulled over unnecessarily and that they were being profiled. But now, you know, you're pulling fewer people over who aren't actually involved in serious crime. And so that goes a long way. And I think that people's attitudes about the department has they've shifted a bit because their experience is different from what it was before.
That's great. So let me interject this for those of you San Franciscans in the room that we also are working with Dr. Eberhardt in Stanford. So I want to make it sound like it's only... So looking at the future, and I know you and I have had conversations about what the future holds, and technology is a big piece of the work. Can you share a little bit with the audience on some of the possibilities with technology, and particularly with the body-worn camera footage and data, linguistics and those type of things that really allow us, I think, to really get at some of the roots of this work and address it and train to it and all that?
Right. So I've been working at Stanford with an interdisciplinary group of researchers, including Dan Jurowski, who's back there. He's a linguist and actually the chair of the linguistics department at Stanford. And so we teamed up with him and also computer scientists and social psychologists. And we were interested in looking at body-worn camera footage as data, as helping to inform us about how these routine interactions go. And so we focused in on traffic stops. And so we didn't look at the high-profile, cases of uses of force or officer-involved shootings. We were interested instead in looking at these everyday encounters that the average person would have with the police officer. And we were trying to understand, how sort of, trust is built or eroded one interaction at a time. And so the footage gave us a window into these interactions. All of a sudden, we can see in real time how that interaction unfolds. And we could never really do that before, right? All we had really were checkboxes. And so we never actually really knew what transpired. And I'm a social psychologist, so I love, being able to really see an interaction up close. And it's a real interaction, right, through the footage. And so we were able to look at the language that officers used in these interactions. And we were interested in looking at the role that race played there. And so we looked at the language they were using with, black drivers versus white drivers. And we found that they were professional overall, but there was a race difference in how they spoke. And so they spoke to white drivers more respectfully than black drivers. And that was the case from the very beginning of the stop to the end of the stop. And so even the greeting, right? So white drivers would get sir and ma'am. Black drivers were more likely to get, bro and dude when they were stopped. Also, white drivers would be offered reassurance. They would be told, it's okay, don't worry, that kind of thing. Black drivers, less so. Towards the end of the stop, officers would express more concern for the safety of white drivers than they would for the safety of black drivers. So it was all these subtle ways. So it wasn't anything that was super egregious here, but there were subtle ways in which respect was being communicated through words that that community members could actually pick up on. So if you gave them snippets of these interactions and they were shown the words that the officers used, they could tell you, okay, this is less respectful, this is more respectful, without even knowing the race of the driver. And in fact, we could use sort of simple models where we were able to tell, or the model was able to tell, just from the words that the officer used alone, whether that officer was talking to a black driver or a white driver. So yeah. It was subtle but real, and something that actually mattered a lot to the community members.
Yeah, and I think from the perspective of a police chief, I think that type of data and being able to take that type of data and really turn it into actionable training, and because I the whole thing about implicit bias is I think some officers probably weren't even aware that was happening.
Yeah.
And it's maybe as odd as that might sound, I think that's probably the truth. But to be able to take that and turn that into training to make us better, I think is a huge and transformative step in law enforcement. I know many departments like us have body-worn camera footage, but to use that to better what we do, I think is huge. So
I think it could be that footage could be leveraged a whole lot more than it is in the industry. And you mentioned that some of these officers probably didn't even know that they were doing it. Some actually did. But it's funny, they were using the language like the bro and dude and all that because they thought it was. They were trying to be more relatable, and so just from their perspective, they were just using the language of community members to connect to them more, and so they thought it was more respectful to use that language. But when we actually asked people, and we asked people in Oakland at the Department of Motor Vehicles, like people who drive, right, in Oakland, they were like, no, that's not respectful. And black drivers said that too. And so getting that, back, receiving that information was important to them because, if you're trying to connect, don't do this. This is not the way to connect.
You're absolutely right. And I've seen that too. And I've seen officers that felt that they were well-intentioned, but they weren't aware that, that is disrespectful behavior. So in terms of everything that is talked about in your book and the personal stories and how that interplays with policing, where do you see that the actual science and the research piece? I mean, 20 years ago, at least when I started 30 years ago, this was not even on the radar.
Yeah.
So where do you see this work going in terms of, I think it's really huge and transformative in terms of the work, but where do you see it going?
I hope this is a maybe this is a lofty goal, but I hope that eventually that it can help to have a sort of positive impact on the on policing more generally, like outside of Oakland, and where this becomes a routine thing, where you can look at these interactions through the footage to learn a lot about what's working and what's not working. Even simple things like you have a change in policy, you want to know if that change is actually being enacted on the ground, and there's no way for you to really know that, right, in one interaction at a time, but you can actually look at the footage to see, see if it is happening. So even things like, consent searches, for example, there are consent searches where I know at least in Oakland you have to be told that you can refuse explicitly that you can refuse a consent search, but how do you how do you really know whether the people say that every time when they do a consent search? So we can look at that, or we can even look at how people are informed about that kind of search and so forth. So there's huge potential, I feel, in actually using that footage not only as evidence for a particular case, but as data across lots of cases, so that you can, better police, do your jobs better, and have, better relationships, with the public. So,
you're out of time, but I want to thank Dr. Eberhard and Chief Scott for coming, and all of you. Good night.
BINA is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was social psychologist Jennifer Eberhard, whose new book is Biased, Uncovering the Hidden Prejudice That Shapes What We See, Think, and Do. She was joined in conversation by San Francisco Police Chief Bill Scott. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Alex Espelay, Dan Folds, Carly Mari, and Aiden Nelson. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Tina Pimentuan is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. BINA is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.